From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
She's ready. She's on the potion.
That's what former pro football star Darren Sharper told a friend about a woman he drugged and would later sexually assault, according to our guest, ProPublica investigative reporter T. Christian Miller. Women in four states made similar accusations against Sharper. On today's show, Miller talks about the Sharper case, how police handle rape investigations, and why it took nearly 3 years for authorities to connect the dots and make an arrest.
So it was a very well-known, you know, pattern. You had a guy who would actively go to a bar, pick up women, spike their drinks, get them back to his apartment, and assault them.
Sharper recently pled guilty to multiple counts of rape and attempted rape. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews an album of trombonist Kaumba Frank Lacey singing Charles Mingus songs. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air. Citizens of Louisiana were shocked last year when Darren Sharper, a beloved member of the New Orleans Saints 2010 Super Bowl team and an NFL Network analyst, was arrested on a sexual assault charge in Los Angeles. It quickly emerged that Sharper had also been accused of rape by women in Miami, New Orleans, Phoenix, and Las Vegas. He would eventually plead guilty or no contest to raping or attempting to rape 9 women in 4 states. Our guest, T. Christian Miller of the nonprofit investigative news site ProPublica, looked into why it took nearly 3 years after the first woman identified Sharper as her attacker for police to make an arrest. Miller worked on the Sharper case with ProPublica colleague Ryan Gabrielson and Ramon Antonio Vargas and John Zimmerman of the New Orleans Advocate. Their investigation raises troubling questions about how police handle rape cases, and in particular, whether a lack of coordination and information sharing among departments lets serial rapists get away with their crimes. This is obviously a disturbing topic, and our conversation will contain descriptions of Darren Sharper's history of serial rape, which may be upsetting to hear. In more than 20 years of journalism, T. Christian Miller has covered wars, human rights abuses, environmental issues, and a presidential campaign. He's won many journalistic awards, including a George Polk Award. Well, T. Christian Miller, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's begin by just talking a bit about Darren Sharper. Who was he as an athlete?
Darren Sharper was a football player, last for the New Orleans Saints. He was famous for his ability to intercept the ball and for his ability to hit hard, kind of legendary, actually. He wound up his career in the NFL final season, winning a Super Bowl with the New Orleans Saints, and that season having recorded the most runs from intercepted balls in league history, setting a new record. So he was a prodigy in his ability specifically to anticipate what was going to happen, to intercept the ball, and to make tackles when it was most important.
Now, some athletes have arrest records or other things in their backgrounds that give them, you know, a sketchy reputation. What about Sharper?
Nothing like that, Dave. When we first started this story, we went to every single police agency in a town or area where he had lived. That was about 20 different agencies. And we filed public record requests for any kind of interaction he'd had with the police. And we got, I believe, 2, one which was during his college years, sort of a complaint about loud noises in the dorm, and a second was a traffic ticket in Wisconsin. But through all his career, which began with the Green Bay Packers, went on to the Minnesota Vikings, and ended in New Orleans, there was never any kind of history or signs of trouble.
So he was a popular player, well-regarded.
Yes, and not only well-regarded, but actually known for his outreach on women's issues. He was so well-known that he was actually included in an NFL publication about battered women and domestic violence, in which he appeared with his daughter in a photo in the calendar and said, I'm appearing kind of to show my support for women and how they can be exploited and abused.
Hmm. So before we talk about the allegations against him specifically, you note that there's a culture of NFL off-season parties. You want to describe that world?
So what we found is that during the off-season, certain players congregate in big nightclub spots, towns like New Orleans, towns like Miami Beach, those kind of places where there's a known club scene, a party scene. At the same time, women who are interested in connecting with or seeing football players and basketball and other sports as well will also go to these towns on the off season. And there are people in these clubs whose job it is to find women who, for whatever reason, are interested in meeting and connecting with an NFL player. And the NFL players are waiting at these different VIP tables, let's say. And kind of the women will gather and be collected up. And the football player can sort of have his choice of whatever woman he wants to go home with. This obviously doesn't apply to every football player, nor to every woman who goes to these clubs. But there is this little system that exists that's to the benefit of the club itself, because the club wants to have high-profile players, and the way to keep them there is to make sure that the football players who wish to indulge in this have a selection of attractive and willing women.
And these are well-paid professional athletes. They'll drop some cash at these tables.
Oh, yeah. One of these intermediaries was telling us it's $15,000 to have a table, and then you're buying drinks all night and buying fancy things, and you basically spend a lot of money, which helps the club out as well. It's a very lucrative thing for a club to have a player there buying one of these tables, and the way to keep them there is to make sure that if they want to have a woman to go home with, that there's some women who want to come to these clubs and do that.
Now, Darren Sharper's playing career ended, I guess, in early 2011, and the first of these allegations comes very shortly thereafter, March of 2011. Two women who were in Miami, I guess doing spring break there. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so he plays his last game in January of 2011, and then in March, he's back at his condo. His main off-season residence is in Miami Beach. He's at a club in Miami Beach, which is famous for attracting glitterati. It's a very big, urban, pulsing nightclub with lots of visuals and music and all kinds of things. And during the night, he meets some women who are on spring break from the University of Georgia. The intermediaries help them connect up, and one thing follows another, and they end up at his condo later in the night. Their story is they were both tired. They had obviously had something to drink. They fell asleep. And one woman recalls waking up with Darren Sharper exposing himself to her. She went back, said stop, that went back asleep. And the next time she woke up, Darren Sharper, she says, was straddling her essentially. At that point in time, woman gets up, contacts her friend. They both notice that they're not wearing any underwear anymore. And they immediately leave and eventually talk to Miami police about this incident.
And so what kind of an investigation was done?
So they went to the hospital and they got what's known as a rape kit. And that's a term which simply means that they had an examination by a nurse who's especially trained to look for forensic evidence that could be used in court. Typically what happens in those kind of examinations is the nurse will go over you. It's a 4-hour to as many as 6-hour long procedure. It can be very uncomfortable. There's a lot of examinations, very intimate examinations that go on. They're looking for all your clothing, anything on your body that may contain DNA evidence. Those rape kits, what's supposed to happen is they are then sent on to a lab to be analyzed. So the lab can say, well, there's DNA on this kit, and this DNA may match a suspect or not.
And typically what happens is that it goes from the hospital to the police's custody, and then it's the police's call whether to send it to a lab for testing. Is that right?
Correct. Once the police get the rape kit, now these rules differ a little bit in every state, but in general, once the police get the rape kit and are doing the investigation, they'll send away the kit for examination to determine what, if anything, is useful in terms of prosecuting the case.
And what happened in this case?
In this case, what we know is the rape kit was not sent onward for further examination and instead was destroyed a year or maybe more after this investigation was closed. So now there's no chance to go back and test that rape kit. And that also raises a lot of questions about why that was done. We know in Miami, the Miami Police Department did virtually nothing. The police officer took the report from Miami Beach Police Department. and closed the case 3 days later, I think it was. Did nothing in terms of trying to find out more about the case. Didn't follow any of the recommendations that the International Police Chiefs Association has issued in terms of how to investigate a rape investigation. But even you and I can think of things you would have done. You would have tried to go and talk to people who were at the apartment, including Jamie Sharper or Darren Sharper. Or you could have interviewed other witnesses that happened that night. Or you could have waited for the sexual assault kit. You could have submitted that and find out if there were any results. But none of that was done in this case. It was just swept under the rug, and a finding was made that not only had no rape occurred, but the whole incident was reclassified as a miscellaneous incident by the Miami Beach Police Department.
The next allegation came later in New Orleans. Tell us about that one.
So about a year after these attacks in Miami, which I want to emphasize, they were never charged against Mr. Sharper. There was an incident in Louisiana. This was in September of 2013. And in that case, Mr. Sharper was at a club. He met a girl. They went to another club. And during that partying atmosphere, everybody's dancing around, and there's a lot of drinking going on. Sharper goes over to one of his friends and says, she's ready. She's on the potion. And then he disappears with her. He takes her to his apartment down in the French Quarter. And according to police, he then basically has sex with her while she's unconscious. There is another woman in the apartment as well who is also raped. And then he has a friend there who's also rapes both women. Woman gets up in the morning, doesn't know what's happened, but knows that she's been assaulted, and reports that to the New Orleans Police Department.
And was a rape kit performed on those two women?
Yes, a rape kit was performed on, well, we know for sure a rape kit was performed on one of the victims, who turns out to be, not this is particularly relevant, but it makes it a particularly high-profile case in the community. She herself is a former cheerleader for the New Orleans Saints, Saint Sation. So awareness of this incident is circulating in the football community, I guess you'd call it. So she does have a rape kit done, and it eventually does come back as testing positive for Darren Sharper's DNA. This is one of the things that makes sexual assault and rape cases so very interesting and difficult to pursue. Because then what happens is, okay, so now I have evidence, certainly, that this man had sex with this woman. But then it comes down to an issue of consent, which is rape, unlike most crimes, there's not a witness. So it comes down to whether or not a jury will believe that the woman in this particular case said yes, or whether she said no, and Darren Sharper went ahead and forced his way onward. And that's what makes rape almost unique amongst violent crimes, is that it depends so much upon the credibility and the believability of the assailant and the victim.
And, of course, on judgments that are made by investigators in the case. What was the reputation of the department's sex crimes unit that investigated this matter?
All right. So the New Orleans sex crimes unit was not exactly in the Super Bowl of sex crimes units. It had been thoroughly reviewed by the Department of Justice, as well as the New Orleans Inspector General, who was an oversight body. And in both those cases, the sexual assault unit as a whole had been found wanting. They weren't investigating cases. They were filing away cases that were legitimate or appeared to be legitimate sexual assault investigations and calling them miscellaneous investigations. And then in particular, there were five detectives singled out as being particularly bad in documenting cases. And one of those five detectives was the detective who was Detective Derek Williams, who was actually investigating Darren Sharper's rape case. And in the report by the New Orleans Inspector General, they singled out Detective Williams as being one of the detectives who had not followed up in 97% of his rape cases.
So do we know enough now about the course of that investigation to have an idea of why it didn't go forward?
Yeah, we have a pretty good idea, Dave. The case was well known up and down the New Orleans police structure up to the highest levels. We're being briefed on the investigation that Detective Williams actually believed he had a case because he did have DNA evidence and he had a witness who's very believable, but that the district attorney in New Orleans and the police chief in New Orleans at the time wanted to have a rock solid case that you couldn't lose, basically. It had to be absolutely rock solid. And that kind of pressure impacted whether or not to go forward with the investigation. And it kind of stalled for a long time. Once again, until the Los Angeles police actually arrested Sharper.
And, of course, this happened in New Orleans, where the suspect, Darren Sharper, had helped them win a Super Bowl. He was an enormously popular and influential guy. He was certainly an enormously popular player. Can you tell whether that affected the way the case proceeded?
So we never got any direct evidence, other than the fact that he was a high-profile person, and that's why the DA and the police chief were a little bit hesitant about going full forward. We talked to one person who said, essentially one cop, who told us, you know, anybody else, if you've got the woman, a name suspect, a DNA evidence thing, the guy would at least be put in jail while they finished the investigation. But this was Darren Sharper. Now, you know, whether or not that was directly linked to his football ability or his fame in New Orleans, it's obviously tied up in there. But we didn't have anybody ever who said, you know, this guy was a football player, so we weren't going to touch him.
We had a reported sexual assault by Darren Sharper in Miami and then another one in New Orleans. The New Orleans investigators didn't know what had happened in Miami. And as this case unfolds, we see police departments not being aware of previous allegations which fit exactly the same pattern. Would that have mattered if they had known about them? Can you introduce, you know, previous allegations as evidence in a case like this?
I think you can see that it would have mattered by the eventual outcome of this case, which is when there was an arrest made, finally, of Darren Sharper, then all these other police agencies dust off their files and they see, oh, we had a Darren Sharper incident too, and most of them begin prosecution. One of the fundamental principles in terms of what police recommend for a rape investigation is, where else has this guy been and what has he done? And that's kind of the whole point of the stories that we've been doing, is that it just should be kind of almost like a protocol step, once you get a rape case, to look back where the guy has lived before. And that's just not sort of me thinking that. That's best practice recommendation from the International Police Chiefs Association and training groups and advocacy groups and everywhere else. And the reason is this. It's really interesting. There's some research that shows amongst the violent crimes like murder and assault, rape is the one which has the highest amount of serial offenders. In other words, a rapist, once you catch him, may have something like a quarter to two-thirds have committed a previous rape. So there's some sense, I mean, there's just a logical sense that you should go back and see, had this guy, when he was living in another place, ever encountered the police? And what we found in our Darren Sharper story and in subsequent stories is that's just not a routine practice. You know, cops are busy. They've got one rape case in front of them. They want to solve that one. But that in reality, those previous incidents can play a role in a decision whether or not to prosecute. It sort of helps the prosecutor, helps the police officer think, this isn't just one incident of he said, she said. It's an incident of they said, he said. And so it gives the police and the prosecutors more reason to pursue the cases. There's another whole separate issue about whether you can introduce those in court. And there is legislation passed that allows you to do that. Again, unique in criminal justice. But at the very least, I think it's very true that if you're a police officer and you know that this guy has been accused in one or two other places by women, maybe never charged, but you know, how many times does that happen? How could that be a complete coincidence? And I think that would make police and prosecutors more aggressive in doing the investigation they have at hand.
Right. And it's not like they'd have to call 50 states. It's not that hard to figure out where a suspect has lived before and call those departments.
Right. I mean, both you and I, as in our careers as journalists, I think it seems so obvious to us because one of the first things you do when you're covering a story is you find out Bob Jones is a murderer. And then you find out, like, where do you live and try and call neighbors and then go back and find more neighbors and try and call them. It's almost second nature, I think, to journalists and many others to just kind of look at this guy's background. But for police, there's not really a big reward in that because you just have to solve the case in front of you. It's not necessarily helpful to them to go backwards.
T. Christian Miller is an investigative reporter for the nonprofit news site ProPublica. Later, we'll hear how authorities finally put the case against Sharper together and about some investigative shortcomings that make it easier for serial rapists to get away with their crimes. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
This episode of Fresh Air is supported by Trunk Club, a men's outfitting service. Trunk Club is designed for guys who don't have the time or desire to go shopping. After signing up, you'll be matched with your own personal stylist who, after getting to know your preferences, will handpick a selection of premium clothing, pack it in a trunk, and ship it all straight to your door. You'll have 10 days to try everything on, keep what you love, and send the rest back. You only pay for what you keep, and shipping is free both ways. Get started at trunkclub.com/freshair.
All right, so there's an allegation against Darren Sharper in 2011 in Miami, another one 2013 in New Orleans, and then another one after that in Los Angeles, all similar, women who say they were drugged and then apparently were sexually assaulted. And then the one in Tempe, Arizona near Phoenix seems to have gotten more attention. Why?
Yeah, so the Phoenix police, when they get this report, they actually begin doing a fairly thorough investigation. We have the best documentation on what exactly they did. So they immediately interview the witnesses. They get tape from the bars where this happened in.
That's the video surveillance tape, right? Yeah.
Video surveillance tapes, right, excuse me, from the bars that he was in. So one of the things that happened is this assault happened in an apartment where there's a group of women that were all living together. And when one of the assaults was going on, there was two women who were assaulted, another woman called her boyfriend to basically say, what should I do? Police had determined that that call had been made. They had actually interviewed the boyfriend. And so they had almost like a contemporaneous another witness to what had occurred. They did get due rape kits tests. They did send those away to the lab. So that investigation was moving along. I wouldn't say it was moving along with alacrity. There was sort of long periods of time when nothing was happening.
But then the big change occurred when another assault was reported in Los Angeles, and that went to the same detective that had gotten an earlier report, right?
Right. So as the police in Arizona are moving along slowly, Darren Sharper is not. He goes back to Los Angeles, back to the same club where he had assaulted two women, and assaults another two women. The same police officer catches that report, and whereas before he only had one report, now he has two reports of the same incident occurring with the same club, same guy, same women, same MO, and he then gets an arrest warrant issued. It's a little too late, although he issued it very quickly, because the same night, I mean, picture this, the same night that he assaults these two women in Los Angeles, he catches a plane to Las Vegas the next day, assaults two more women within 24 hours, and then the Las Vegas police are also on to him. He flies back to Los Angeles, and that's where he is arrested at the hotel where he is staying.
And how did these police departments finally begin communicating with each other about Darren Sharper?
It was the news. As soon as Darren Sharper was arrested, the LAPD issued a news alert that they had arrested this ex-NFL football player. Louisiana read that. Arizona saw that. Florida saw that. And all of a sudden, now, whereas before they hadn't shown much interest in investigating these rapes, now they all begin an effort to find out if their victims had also been raped by Darren Sharper. So it kicks into high gear at that point in time. And one of the points in our story was that not that the police did a bad job when they began really investigating Darren Sharper, but that it actually took this high-profile arrest to make them go back and really scrub their files.
And the depressing thought is that if he weren't famous, it might not have happened. I mean, these other departments might never have known that a guy had done the same thing with a similar MO.
Sure, I can absolutely see that happening. If he was just a regular guy and they found him, that it may never have gone out to anywhere else because there is no centralized database of people who commit sexual assault.
And once these cases emerged, was there a clear MO for Darren Sharper? What did he do in all these cases?
Yeah, so what emerges is a kind of a disturbing picture of a very calculating serial rapist. In most of the cases, he met his victims in clubs. In most of the cases, he slipped a Mickey to the women, as it was called in old days. He essentially mixed their drinks, and while he was mixing the drinks, he poured in Ambien or Valium into the drinks at the same time and then served it to them. And he called those frat drinks in one case. And another time, as I mentioned, he called it the potion, and he would give these women the potion. So he would give them Valium, he would give them Ambien, take them back to his apartment. They would often pass out or have very foggy memories of what occurred. They were often very young, college-age women, blonde, white women, who he picked up in these clubs, who even when you look at their pictures, they look kind of similar. And so it was a very well-known, you know, pattern. You had a guy. Sometimes he took photos of these assaults and pictures when they were going on, when they were happening. Sometimes he would brag about that in text messages to friends of his. So it was definitely a kind of a deliberate pattern that happened over and over again by this football star.
So eventually, all of these cases emerged. It did not go to trial. A plea agreement was reached among many of the prosecutors. What does it provide in jail time, for example?
So his plea deal provides for him to get a 20-year sentence. There's a catch, though. He's been in jail since his arrest in 2014. So that, along with credit for good time that he's expected to get, will mean that he's only going to serve about 9 more years in prison.
Good time, essentially, time off for good behavior in prison, right?
Correct.
So 20-year sentence, if things go to his advantage, he'll end up serving only 9 more years.
That's right. He'll serve 9 more years for the rape of 9 women.
There were other conditions imposed along with the sentence, right? Tell us about those.
There were a number of other conditions. The one that attracted the most attention was a condition that he wear what's called a penile plethysmograph when so ordered to do by his parole officer. And what that is, a penile plethysmograph is essentially a cuff that goes around your penis. You go to a lab, you are shown pornography, violent pornography often, rape pornography, and the device measures your reaction to that. And if you have a reaction which is deemed unworthy, you can be sent to counseling, you can be sent to prison again. But it's something which is at the discretion of the parole officer. So just to be clear, he doesn't have to wear this all the time. But if any parole officer decides needs to be tested with this penile plethysmograph, he would have to come in and undergo this procedure.
Now, it's lifetime parole, right? So this will be this way. He has to put up with this forever. He's not allowed any alcohol, right?
Right, no alcohol.
Has to register as a sex offender.
Yes, registered sex offender. He can't even use the internet to communicate with other women in an attempt to get a date. So what one person told us, what one defensive prosecutor told us when we asked about this deal and was it a sweetheart deal, the person told us this is designed to fail. In other words, there are so many conditions that the expectation is he's going to screw this up and have to return to prison for life. That's a defense. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but that's a defense that was certainly in the prosecutor's thinking.
Not to dwell on it, but it seems to me that the penile plethysmograph would be the kind of test you would give somebody if you'd gotten some counseling and treatment for to try and deal with this preference for coercive sex. Is that part of what's supposed to happen too?
That is part of what's supposed to happen, but I think you're right to dwell on it as lurid as it may be, because honestly, there's not a lot of science behind this penile plethysmograph as to whether it measures anything or not. The research shows that it can be easily fooled. It seems like a relic of an era when people thought this might actually do something, but there's no real hard science that shows that the penile plethysmograph measures much of anything.
I'm sure Darren Sharper had good attorneys and they negotiated the plea agreement. Have we heard anything from him about these crimes?
Yes, he certainly apologized for his crimes, but there hasn't been any kind of extensive outreach to the victims that I'm aware of, at least not publicly so. There's one hitch to this whole plea deal right now, which is that in both the New Orleans and in the federal level, they haven't yet accepted the plea. So, and there's a lot of speculation as to why that is. We don't actually know, have a very good idea as to why neither in the judge in New Orleans nor the judge in the federal district court has not accepted the plea agreement yet. That's not going to happen until sometime this fall. So we're just sort of watching to see if the full agreement is actually enacted.
You know, clearly one of the things that went wrong in the Darren Sharper case, as you reported, is that departments in several states were getting reports of Sharper and in some cases other folks drugging and raping women, but they didn't know about the other incidents. And so a nationwide database which connects dots would be a really good idea. And you write that, in fact, decades ago, the FBI saw this and tried to build one. What happened?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's a fascinating story about good intentions that were never followed through. So 30 years ago, there was a famous detective in Los Angeles, the LAPD, named Pierce Brooks. And he's most famous. He was the detective in Joseph Wambaugh's The Onion Field, who solved the murder of a cop killer. So Brooks, who was very forward-thinking, realized that serial killers and other criminals kind of behaved in certain ways that might help identify them. So they might use a certain knife in all their crimes, or they might whistle a particular song as they're doing their nefarious activities. And this is long before DNA was a thing, a known science. So it was kind of an early version of trying to identify people not through their genetic materials, but kind of through their behaviors, what they did, how they acted during a crime. So Brooks manages to convince Congress, the late Senator Arlen Specter, to fund a program that would look at these behavioral clues. It was called the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program, VICAP for short, and it kicked off in 1985. In the same bureau where the profilers, who'd be later made famous in Silence of the Lambs, they had this computer system that was called VICAP and was supposed to find out, you know, what were other serial killers doing or how could you connect them together. Eventually, it was adapted also for rapists so that rapists, if they behaved in a certain way and offended serially, would be identified by this VICAP system. And that's how it began and has been in function ever since.
And has it worked?
So the short answer to that is not often. It has certainly been used to solve cases. The FBI won't comment on how many cases exactly it's been used, but there are certainly examples, which they provided to me when I was doing my reporting, of how best VICAP system helped solve some cases. But in general, it's just not used. I mean, the FBI, this is kind of like a forgotten stepchild for the FBI. It began in 1985, pre-DNA. Then DNA came along and people kind of forgot about this behavioral database. So the agency has never really done anything to promote it very heavily. It's a $800,000 a year program. the budget of the FBI is $8.2 billion, which just, if you put your money where your mouth is, that shows what their where their mouth is. There's only about 1,400 police agencies, which are today use this database, and there's 18,000 in the country. So you can see that not very many police agencies are actually using it. And then there's not very many rapes even being entered. There's less than 1% of all rapes that occur in the country are entered into this database on a yearly basis. So it's a everyone that I spoke to for this story said, great idea, great potential, is just not doing the job.
Well, obviously, for it to be effective, you need to have data entered from, you know, all of these local law enforcement agencies. What do the local cops say about why they don't bother to enter this data into the to the system?
There's a couple reasons. Number one, it's just not very well known because it's not been marketed very well. Number two, when it is known, it's a very cumbersome form to fill out. There's, I think, almost 100 or so questions which they have to go to. It takes 45 minutes or so, which for a cop, you know, on the beat, detective on the beat, that's a lot of time to take out. And then finally, and kind of most significantly, I think, it's simply not mandatory. In the U.S., at least, police don't have to enter this information into the VICAP database, and so they don't.
You spent some time in your reporting here talking to a lot of people involved in rape investigations and advocates who want to see them done more aggressively and more effectively. Are things changing? Are investigators' attitudes changing? Are techniques and legislation evolving so that this can be more effectively investigated and prosecuted?
The advocates that I spoke to have that hope, but I don't know if there's a lot of evidence of that. And the most kind of trenchant statistic I had is that there's about 15,000 murders a year. There's 80,000 rapes a year. If you had one murder in your community, you'd be very upset. And if you have 20 rapes in your community, you probably don't even know that. So there's a sense that in general, rape is a crime that it is difficult to solve. It is fraught with all sorts of issues, but it also doesn't appear to be first in the minds of detectives in America's police forces. Some places, yes, of course. But in general, the homicide unit is where the best guys work. The sex crimes unit tends to be a place where you clock your time and move on. There's not often in many agencies a command focus by leadership on solving rape cases. So in the end, something like 60% of violent crimes like murder and assault are solved. Only about 40% of sexual assault crimes are solved, according to the FBI. But that statistic is made even different by there's 15,000 murders a year. We know that. We've seen the bodies. There's 80,000 reported rapes, but by most estimates, only 1 in 3 rapes are actually reported. So if you go by that, there's 240,000 rapes per year in this country, and very few of those ever get prosecuted.
Well, T. Christian Miller, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Dave. I really appreciated being on.
T. Christian Miller is an investigative reporter for the nonprofit news site ProPublica. He co-authored a series on the Darren Sharper case with ProPublica colleague Ryan Gabrielson and Ramon Antonio Vargas and John Zimmerman of the New Orleans Advocate.
Support for this podcast comes from AT&T. With AT&T, the network is on demand, so the office is mobile and the cloud is designed for high security. Learn more at att.com/focus.
Off and on for 2 decades, trombonist Kaumba Frank Lacey has played in New York's Mingus Big Band, dedicated to the music of the late Charles Mingus. On the band's new album, Lacey steps out front, singing a batch of Mingus songs. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's weirdly right.
Lot of pictures, most of the beauties of the world, from places I've traveled, I still recall. the quaint melody as I feel, painting my own.
Composer Charles Mingus loved words as well as music. He was writing lyrics and using singers from the first, and would sing or recite his own texts later. He also wrote jazz's great autobiographical novel, the stylish, funny, and disturbing Beneath the Underdog. Mingus always got to the heart of things. His lyrics, like his performances, might overflow with feeling. This is from the young Charles Mingus's Weird Nightmare.
You're there to haunt me when you say she doesn't want me. I've been hurt. Do you know what that means? Weird nightmare. Take away the grief you've shared. Weird nightmare. Mend a heart that's torn and has paid the price of love a thousandfold. Bring me a love with a heart of gold.
Weird Nightmare, first recorded in 1946, sung by Kaumba Frank Lacey. It's from the not-so-accurately titled album Mingus Sings, co-starring Lacey and the Mingus Big Band. Frank Lacey's voice and blustery delivery can be comically gruff, but he gets the right earnest intensity. And he knows all the Mingus-y inflections from playing in the band, with a trombonist's cracked timing and attention to every note's pitch and vibrato. Lacey has what Mingus prized, a strong individual voice. This is Dry Cleaner from Des Moines, with Joni Mitchell's lyric about an Iowan's hot streak in Vegas.
I talked to a cat from Des Moines. He said he ran a cleaning plant. The cat was cranking with corn. Well, he must have had a genie in his lamp. Cause every time I dropped a dime, I blew it. He kept ringing bells, nothing to it. He got three oranges, three lemons, three cherries, three palms. I'm losing my tongue for fruit. Watching the dry cleaner do it, like Midas in a polyester suit. It's all luck, it's just luck. You get a little lucky and you make a little money.
Scoffery on tenor saxophone. Charles Mingus's melodies can move in odd ways, but they're oddly singable. The weird dips make voices sound good. The lyricists heard from on Mingus Sings also include Elvis Costello, who sent a couple of tongue twisters, and there's a recitation penned by poet Langston Hughes. I admit I prefer Mingus's own words, heard on four tunes here. That said, while drummer Doug Hammond was with Mingus in the 70s, he penned a sharp lyric for the previously unheard tune, Dizzy Profile. It's about trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie and how revolutionary ideas lose their sting over time and how to maybe fix that.
There was a time a friend of mine would play a melody and there would be a song. Man used to say, a crazy friend, but when he would play a trumpet sound, we all would gather round. Make the song be my brother's name. But misunderstanding came to turn around its meaning then. What the music said to play about, we always never knew until we heard the sound. So remember now that crazy sound, then we will begin to understand a storyline again.
Kaumba Frank Lacey and the Mingus Big Band, with trumpeters Jack Walrath, Alex Norris, and Lou Soloff, who passed away not long after the recording. Mingus would teach musicians melodies by singing them, and his horns could sound eerily like his voice. This Mingus Big Band catches that vocalized quality. It doesn't hurt one of their own is singing out front. There are good soloists new and old, including saxophonists Alex Foster and Craig Handy, and a couple of newly unearthed compositions. The title Mingus Sings is a shameless cheat, but the music's worthy of the Mingus brand.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed Mingus Sings, featuring Kaumba Frank Lacey and the Mingus Big Band on the Sunnyside label. On tomorrow's show, after 16 years, Jon Stewart is stepping down as host of The Daily Show. What will America do without him? We'll listen to excerpts of our interviews with him and with one of his executive producers. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Whenever you say you love me, whenever you say you care, horses and warlocks warn me, the sorceress sing beware. Still I don't believe in dragons or portions of witches' brew. How can I win all the magic I need in my life is you.